In the late 1960s, a novice film producer, Warren Steibel, best known for his collaborations with William F. Buckley to produce the political Talking Heads commentary show Firing Line, put together a low-budget production with a cast of unknown actors and an opera librettist by the name of Leonard Castle, who, through circumstance, wound up to be the film's director. The fruit of this collaboration was a film that was destined to gain an unlikely cult audience of admirers, from high art directors to common everyday folks who, for whatever reason, were grabbed by this story about two lovers on the run, based on historical events, portrayed in inimitable characterizations by Tony LoBianco and Shirley Stoller. The Honeymoon Killers eventually wound up in the Criterion Collection. Released in February 1970, The Honeymoon Killers now proudly wears spine number 200. In this 13th episode of Criterion Reflections, I'm joined by Josh Hornbeck and Arik Devins. My name's David Blakesley. Join us as we discuss Leonard Castle's The Honeymoon Killers. Hello, listeners. We are back for Criterion Reflections, episode 13, in which I and a couple of friends of mine will be discussing Leonard Castle's 1970 release, The Honeymoon Killers. Joining me today are Josh Hornbeck. Hello, Josh.
Hi. How are you today, David?
Dealing with a little bit of a cold, so I will hopefully not have to, take breaks or let it mar my performance, if you will. But other than that, I'm doing good and really eager to hear you guys' impressions of this film. The third party, the third wheel in our little trio here, in our triangle, so to speak, is Arik Devins. Arik, how are you?
Not suffering from a lonely heart, thankfully.
Well, good. Yes, that's right. You've actually got an engagement, a real engagement,
a legit engagement. I don't think anyone's trying to steal my money. If they are, it's a very long plan.
The longest con,
exactly.
All right. Well, guys, I am very pleased to have you along with me as I work through some of my issues with this film. This is a unique, interesting release as we kind of dig a little bit further into the films of 1970. This is the third in our series as we get into this very early era of the new decade here on Criterion Reflections. The Honeymoon Killers, directed by Leonard Castle. He was probably best known as a writer and maybe a librettist for an opera, and this is the only film he ever directed. So there's one mark of distinction. The other very interesting point is that this is spine number 200, and maybe we can get back to that a little bit later. Maybe we'll talk about the film first and then talk about a little bit about the placement within the Criterion Collection as an afterthought. But this is spine number 200. The hundreds seem to have some kind of significance. We can kind of sift through that. But Josh, I'm going to kind of kick it over to you. I've already intimated, I've got some mixed thoughts on this film, and maybe you guys do too. I really don't know what your takes are, but again, I appreciate you joining me. So, Josh, take it away. Tell us a little bit about this movie.
Yeah, thanks for having me on this. Warren Steibel was a producer. He was a TV producer, and he produced a PBS show called Firing Line with William F. Buckley, and he really wanted to get into film. He wanted to get into film production, so he borrowed money from a friend and decided that he wanted to adapt the story of the Lonely Hearts murderers, and sent his friend Leonard Castle, who was an opera composer and librettist, to do the research and to write the story. And so it was kind of a weird situation. None of them had worked in film before at all. None of them worked in film again afterwards. And they they kind of threw this production together. They hired Martin Scorsese to start filming, but he was fired after a week for being too slow because they only had $150,000 to shoot this. They had 7 weeks. They hired theater actors mainly. And so it all has a very low budget feel to it. And Leonard Castle eventually took over the filming after he was the third director brought on because the assistant director was also taking too long. He was taking too many takes. And so Leonard Castle came in and really rehearsed with the actors beforehand each day. And then they would do one, maybe two takes at the most. But most of the shots were done in one take. And there are times when you can feel that they were only done in one take.
Yes. All right. Well, yeah, thank you for kind of setting us up there, Josh. Arik, why don't you kind of take a shot at it here and give us your impressions, kind of opening up.
Sure. I'm hoping that this conversation actually will clarify and crystallize my impressions of the film. And I say that because I was watching it and my fiance, who we've mentioned already, was like, "Oh, how's the movie?" And I'm like, "Yeah, I don't know. I don't like it, but I don't know why." And I was like, "That's so boring." But at the same time, it was really, really well done in certain areas. Like some of the cinematography is really beautiful and really interesting. Kind of in that Faces, John Cassavetes kind of vibe. Like a lot of some of the dramatic scenes in the film are really interestingly, like some really interesting choices were made even more dramatic by the idea that they only had like one or two takes to get it right. Some of it is really, really impressive. Some of the acting is awful. There's one line in particular that I just cannot believe they kept in the script. I'm sure you both know which line I'm talking about. Are we allowed to? Can I say the line, David?
Oh, go. Yeah.
Yeah.
Lay it out there.
It's when Martha is fired from her job and apparently her boss was Jewish, and she says, "You know, I'm not convinced that Hitler wasn't wrong about you people." And I'm like, "What the hell is the point of that?" Mm-hmm.
We'll get into some of these shock moments for sure. Yeah,
the movie is fairly famously in Criterion circles, I would say controversial. Some people defend it to high heaven, and some people are really like, "How did this ever get in?" I don't have that issue. I totally see that it's a valid entry. Not that that matters anyway, but I totally see why it's in the collection. But I didn't connect with this one, I don't think. But I don't know. Since I watched it, sometimes when you watch a film and then you kind of live with it for a while, I've seen it a few times now, and I it's growing on me in a weird way. I haven't quite crossed the line from don't like to like yet, but I think I will. I don't know. I'm confused.
Wow. Well, Arik, I mean, you and I are tracking on this very same journey.
Ah, okay.
Okay, so I had never seen this film before, okay? I have owned the DVD for years.
Yeah.
I did the obligatory Blu-ray upgrade.
Me too.
I am a completionist and all of that. But because it came up on my queue, I was like, okay, got to watch this thing. I watched it just earlier this week, and in between the... some events that I was a part of, I'll just say the writer-director Paul Schrader, who hails from West Michigan, where I live, he did a couple nights on Monday and Tuesday of this week when we're recording. This is, 24th of February, something like that. So he was in town, so I got to see a sneak preview of Paul Schrader's newest film called First Reformed, which is powerful, and of course having the director in the house with a packed West Michigan audience eager to check out his latest expression. And then the next night he gave a presentation at Calvin College, which is both his and my alma mater. We both earned our bachelor's degree there, and it was really a cool moment to hear his thoughts on the transcendental style in film. So I'm kind of at this high art level, if you will, because he's talking about Dreyer, Bresson, Ozu, Bergman, you know, the seminal influences on his work. And then my mission, of course, podcasting wise, is to watch this film, and I'm like, holy cow, what a come down this is.
Listen, it was Truffaut's favorite film, so...
Well, that's the thing. This is part of my journey. So in this very compressed period of time, I watched this film, gave it not a cursory glance, but my first impression was, yeah, this is about a 2.5 star out of 5 film. I mean, there are some things I just wasn't ready to get on board with. I mean, given the school shootings and just this whole issue of violence and killing, I'm not quite in the mood to laugh about murder, you know. so there's that, and then there's this kind of issue about mockery, condescension, kind of targeting certain portions of the population for cheap laughs, and they're like, I'm just not so cool with that. Though I do get a bit of insight into the topic of the times, you know, 68 69 70, again, this era that I'm kind of focusing on. I understand a little bit about the satirical angle here, but this was a first-time watch without viewing any of the supplements, without viewing any of the background in this film, and I'm thinking, yeah, this is just kind of a gaudy piece of trash cinema here that Criterion chose to enshrine for their own reasons. Now, having gone through the supplements, having watched the film a second time, having really paid attention to the craft and the kind of the artistic element here, yeah, there is a little bit more going on than just sheer exploitation. So this is my struggle. This is where I wrestle with the Honeymoon Killers. I think I'm in a similar space as you, Eric, where there are things that I can kind of just dismiss and even scorn a bit, but then there's other things that's like, yeah, I think I see where the love is coming from a certain portion of the audience there. So yeah, I'm wrestling.
Yeah, I first saw it back when Criterion had their partnership with Mubi.
Oh, wow.
And they were offering their weekly film festivals.
Yeah.
And so I watched it, and I watched Deep Crimson right afterwards as well, which is an adaptation of this.
Yeah. Of the same basic underlying story, right?
But more like glamorized, yeah. Right?
I don't think it was as glamour. I don't think it's more glamorized. It's more competently executed, I think. But it's but it still has that same horror and the same shock that you get, I think, with Honeymoon Killers.
Mm. Deep Crimson. So that's the one from like France or for Italy or something.
Mexico, I think. Yeah, and then I know that there was another one a few years ago called Alleluia, which was also
like Belgian or something.
It's a Belgian, yeah, I think so. Yeah. And I haven't seen that one. I don't know how many more adaptations of this story I need to watch. but I watched it again when the Blu-ray came out, and I think I've been on that similar journey of beginning to appreciate it a little bit more each time I watch it. And then watching it again last night to refresh my memory. There's this thing that happens at the beginning where all the performances are so stilted and so theatrical. You get the sense of all of these actors who started on the stage and don't know how to make that transition into working on film. And so things are a little heightened and just they don't feel right on screen. But as the film goes on, I feel like it starts to work on you and you start to buy into the low rent aesthetics of the film. Mm-hmm. And so yeah. I found by the end I get really sucked in every time I watch it.
Hmm. Yeah, I hear you.
It's interesting because this isn't even the only film with a similar plot as this in the collection, right? I mean, Badlands is kind of in that zone. They Live by Night is a little bit in that zone.
And Bonnie and Clyde would be.
Bonnie and Clyde would be. And this film was a reaction to Bonnie and Clyde, right? Wasn't Leonard Castle famously thought that movie was just glamorizing the situation?
Well, right. I mean, with Bonnie and Clyde, you've got two of the most utterly gorgeous people on the planet.
Yeah.
You know, Warren Beatty, Faye Dunaway. You know, it's sexy. It's going for the money. It's you know, you're killing bankers and people who work for the system, you know?
Yeah.
And so there is this kind of distance where, yeah, you can kind of identify with them, these outlaws on the run, just going for it, you know, just going for broke, nothing to lose, live fast, die young, die beautiful, all of that. And so there's a romanticism about the criminal escapade there that is not quite what you get here. This is more like ordinary, schlubby, mediocre people.
Low rent crime.
Totally low rent. And exploiting an extremely vulnerable and rather sympathetic population, although not entirely sympathetic. There are some aspects of these women who are that are quite unlikable, and that's that's where this weird twistedness gets in there. So, yeah, I'm still sorting it out, and the moral equilibrium may never quite be achieved with this film, but I'll continue to engage. So we've got this story. Maybe we should summarize, you know, the basic plot here, because this is the other thing. This is a true story, right? This is kind of proclaimed pretty loud. Well, semi-true. It's based on historic events.
It is
based on a notorious crime spree that is probably, well, I not probably, certainly is not as well known now as it was back in
40s,
69, 70. Right. I mean, this happened in the late 1940s, and I think about maybe a movie like I, Tonya, which is just coming out, which is about another, you know, completely different orientation, but in some ways, but kind of taking events that were pretty well known from like a decade or two prior and saying, yeah, let's use this material for something in today's context. And so this is part of my other sort of secondary take on the film, is that the real life tragedy, not just of the, you know, the exploitation, the con jobs, the killings, but also the way that this was covered in the media and really sensationalized, kind of burned this impression on the mass public consciousness, so that a film based on the exploits of Martha and Ray in 1969/1970, you know, a lot of people alive and watching movies at that time had some kind of memory, or they'd heard of it, or it made some kind of impression on them that we probably don't have nowadays. And so maybe we should just summarize the story itself. Anybody want to take a shot at that?
I can try. The film follows a woman named Martha Beck, who is a nurse and very intense at her job, very, you know, in charge. But at home, you know, kind of like living with her mother, and kind of has a friend who's helping take care of her mother, but she's unhappy. She is considered to be, for her time period, extremely physically unappealing because she's somewhat overweight, and she's desperate for any sort of interpersonal relationship with a man. And her friend signs her up for a sort of precursor to computer dating, a pen pal dating service, a friendship club. And the first person to write her, or the first and only person we see writing her, is this man named Ray Fernandez, who tells her that he's from Spain, he's in the import business, and he has never written one of these letters before, but he was drawn to her because she's a nurse, and so he feels like she probably has a lot of capacity for caring, and that he wants to write to her. Now, as he's doing this, we see the pictures of many other similar ladies on his desk, so we get the feeling that, you know, something is not exactly as it seems here. But he starts writing to her. She starts writing to him. We get like a montage of them sort of falling for each other in quick succession. And then eventually he comes to visit and charms the heck out of her and her mom. And eventually they sort of hook up, and it becomes very clear that he's a con man who tries to take money from these women, and he sort of discovers that she doesn't have a lot of money. He gets like a minor loan from her, but there doesn't look like there's any more, so he writes her a Dear Jane letter. And in response, she pretends to have tried to kill herself and has her friend call him, and his response is to say, okay, you can come visit me in New York. She's living in Georgia somewhere, I think, Mobile, Alabama. And when she gets up to New York, he reveals to her what he truly is, that he's this con man who tricks these women and says, do you still want to be with me? And she says, absolutely. And he says, okay. And so then she begins to pretend to be his sister as they go around to various other ladies that he has struck up correspondence with and attempts to steal their money as well. And so we see that the first one they do, she jumps the gun a little bit on stealing the stuff, and the woman kind of gets wise and runs away. The next one, She gets frustrated because the woman's really trying to, you know, have her marital bed, if you will. And so Martha gives her an overdose of sleeping pills, and they put her on a bus, and she dies on the bus. And this kind of progresses, and they eventually end up with this woman who has like $10,000 or something, and has endorsed all these checks to them, and then kind of at the last minute realizes this is a little suspicious, and kind of tries to call her family, and they end up murdering her with a hammer and burying her in the basement of the house that they're staying in. And from there they go to your home state.
Yes. And that was another big part of my sort of mental psychological flip on this film. It's not just that they go to Michigan. They literally land just a couple miles away from where I live.
Oh, really?
I mean, it freaked me out when I discovered this. Okay, so there's an address given, 3435 Byron Center
right.
Road.
Right, yeah.
And the street I live on is completely parallel to Byron Center Road. Wow. It's like three blocks over. I'm at in the 2200 block.
Uh-huh.
And so basically about 2 miles, 2.5 miles from where I live is where this last murder was committed.
And is that the real address from the real murder?
I believe so, because they actually give us a couple specific addresses in the film. Mm. And my hunch is that they must have based this on some kind of, you know, factual research.
Right.
I mean, Byron Center Road, which is now Byron Center Avenue, is, like I say, just a couple miles from my house, and it is a vacant lot.
Oh, wow.
You can see the house right next to it. You can see the space where a house ought to be.
Yeah.
And it's creepy.
Wow.
Right, so I heard him talking about Grand Rapids. I was like, what do we mean Grand Rapids? Byron Center Road. What? Wait. And so I did some historic research. I will also have another couple links to the local connection. And then in the special supplements here, there's a front page reproduction of the Grand Rapids Press, our local newspaper, where this crime of the century was first discovered.
Oh, my goodness.
And so now all of a sudden, this is like in a very
pulled
remote,
you in.
But definitely very tangible way. This is part of my story, because this is like my neighborhood that where these things kind of came to a head. And so, yeah, so that's the thing, this juxtaposition between the historic events, which were really lurid and really hideous. I mean, there were many other killings associated with this couple.
Up to 20, right?
Yeah, 17 to 20, somewhere in that neighborhood.
Crazy.
And it is. It's really quite a shocker, but some of the elements that made it into the film, Ray Fernandez, this suave, pseudo debonair, smooth talking, Latin lover there, there's that. There's Martha Beck, the overweight woman with kind of her desperate, clingy jealousy and her desire to, kind of exert some kind of control over this man who has latched on to her because she is kind of his perfect accomplice. She will literally do anything to stay on his good side, and he recognizes that she can be an asset to his hustling game. But man, it's just so devious and so twisted. And it is that's part of the intrigue. It's like it pulls you in, but it's also repulsive at the same time. and that's mm-hmm. like how far do I really want to go down this rabbit hole?
I thought that the real life story, as you said, significantly more lurid even than the film. The thing that caught my eye wasn't even just how many more murders, but the fact that she had two kids, and when he said you can come with me, but you have to get rid of the kids, she just dropped them off at like the Salvation Army. And just left.
I didn't even know you could do that.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
Like, would you leave him in front of a firehouse? Like, what are we doing here? Like,
yeah. It's crazy. Well, and his assertion that by her getting rid of her kids, that meant that she really loved him. Mm. There's just something so twisted about their relationship, just from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
Right. And then you get into this kind of this post-war period where there's all these women, widows, for whatever reasons, whatever walks of life they may be from, they're clearly the targets of this couple, both in this film and in the, again, the history behind the scenes there. And that's a whole nother thing as well. It's just kind of like this really cruel exploitation of what I think is a pretty common basic need of emotional connection and companionship. I mean, these women were not, you know, these kind of edgy, you know, living dangerously types who were putting themselves at risk intentionally and reaping the consequences. They really were looking for security and stability and kindness and warmth. Again, the way they're portrayed in the movie, each of these women is really kind of this babe in the woods, this lamb among wolves. Josh, what are some of the thoughts about some of the victims and kind of the ways that they were exploited?
Yeah, I think something that struck me as I was thinking about it last night, after watching it again, you know, we see a lot of these victims through the eyes of the killers to start with. It's the only way I think that we can follow this journey. They're kind of grotesque at times. I think about the scene where the school teacher is in the bathtub singing hymns, and there's a
American patriotic type of thing, right?
Yeah, and there's this kind of ridiculousness to her, to Myrtle, the woman who's pregnant and is just looking for a husband that she can take home to her parents to legitimize the pregnancy. But as it goes on, they get less and less ridiculous. They get less and less over the top. Mm-hmm. And especially the death of Janet and Delphine at the end.
Yeah, that's the one.
Those are just really horrific. And, you know, Janet's, you know, her little isn't that cute thing that kind of grates on you, and as I'm sure grates on the characters as well. We don't like her a whole lot. She's a penny pincher. She's very rude to the characters. But that sequence where she realizes that they're going to kill her it makes your heart sink. It's horrific. And I think that Castle does a good job of pulling you out of that disgust that we have for the characters at times. And gets you to really see this violence for what it is. And then Delphine's at the end is probably the most tragic and the most horrific.
Well, her daughter.
That close-up, yeah. And that close-up on her eyes is really powerful. It's a really powerful shot. And again, she's the least ridiculous of all the characters, even though they're having a birthday cake for Abraham Lincoln and which is kind of silly, but she's not quite in the same camp as a lot of the other women that we see, and I think that the film slowly gets us to empathize with the women by the end.
Yeah, and I think these are mostly scripted scenes. I mean, Leonard Castle was not working off of, you know, eyewitness transcripts of conversations that were had between Ray and Martha and their eventual victims.
Yeah, this isn't in cold blood.
Yeah.
No, right. No. They characterized each of the women as a sort of a specific type. All of them white, all of them, you know, middle-aged or older. I believe all of them seem to have been married at least at one. Well, no, I guess the first one, the school teacher, was a spinster, you know, so there is this comedic element, you know, spinster. Doesn't that mean maiden? You know, there's this, you know, kind of throwing it back in your face, and there's like kind of poking fun at these, you know, middle class bourgeois women, not really wealthy, but just kind of frumpy, conservative, straight laced, uptight, all of that. And again, you put it in the context of the audience likely to see this film. They were either their moms or some kind of square old biddies that they worked with or whatever. And so I kind of get the cultural tension here that we're kind of having some laughs at the expense of these victims, but it doesn't stay there. And
yeah.
And that's the thing. It's I think my first impression was of one of a bit of condescension, that we're just sort of, you know, making fun of these people, which in some ways I know people like this. I can identify with them. I have them in my family and all of that. But I don't necessarily, you know, embrace their values or their, you know, conservatism or their overall take on life. But I still, at the same time, my heart goes out to them because, like, they don't really deserve this. You know, I may have my issues with how they, you know, parse out the world and all of that, but come on, they're just nice ladies who are looking for love in apparently the wrong places here.
Well, for me, I think what Josh said is super relevant. I hadn't really thought about it until he said it, which is cool. Is that they kind of, it was a progression for sure of like kind of dislikable to more likable. Not that you deserve to be cheated and murdered if you're dislikable, but culminating really in Delphine, whose only crime, quote unquote, was to actually fall for Ray and get pregnant by him, right? And then for not only for her to be shot in the head from close range with the camera close on her eyes, very faces and very intense, but also to have Martha take her, what do you think, 5-year-old daughter, 4-year-old daughter, down.
In real life, she was only 2. She was more like a toddler.
Wow.
So they aged her a little bit there. They didn't show the crime on screen.
Martha takes her down to the basement and drowns her.
Right.
And, I mean, that is like, oh, my God. And then in real life, so in the movie, we didn't get to this. So Martha realizes. So Martha says, okay, Martha's been pressuring Ray to be like, okay, when are we going to be done doing this? I want to just be with you. And he keeps being like, one more. And then he says, one more again. And she realizes that he's never going to. First of all, he's never going to stop sleeping with his women, even though he says he's not going to. And second of all, he's never going to actually stop. And so she calls the police and turns them in, and they get sent to Sing Sing and eventually executed, but not before pledging their love to each other. But in real life, Martha was not sympathetic in this way. What happened was that they stayed in the house of this woman in this empty lot that now exists there. I can't believe you found that out. That's incredible. And
I had no choice.
Absolutely.
What really went on here?
And they went out to a nice dinner, like had a nice night on the town. And eventually the father or stepfather, I forget, of Delphine thought something seemed fishy and called the police. And the police came and actually almost let them go even then, but found in the basement the freshly dug plots where they had buried them, and that's why they were ultimately arrested. So the movie kind of makes Martha seem like, because Martha in the movie, who did you think was kind of driving this in the film? Was it, did you feel like it was more Ray or more Martha?
I felt it was this kind of, it was Martha's jealousy that really started leading towards the killings. It was her jealousy that led her to give Myrtle the overdose of pills. I don't know. It's a tough thing, because then when we get into the murder of Janet, it's Ray that tells her, you need to hit her over the head with this hammer. If you love me, you'll hit her over the head with the hammer.
Yeah, that's
if you
a
love
fun
me,
one.
You'll do it, right. And Ray's inability to settle down in Valley Stream, you know, he cannot settle for the domestic life that Martha was really asking for or dreaming of. She really did feel like this was true love, and again, you do their historic research, you read up a little bit. Martha's life was just so incredibly
horrific,
racked with pain and torment, and it's like, again, I'm not really about enabling or creating sympathy for these monstrous characters, but the basic fact is her values just got twisted. She was exploited, raped, abused, and she found what she considered true love, and so she was willing to accompany Ray, and in a very real sense very much enabled him to continue his own homicidal fixations and exploitation of all these other women. So it was just a really awful combination of her desperation, of his mania, and his willingness to, you know, exploit and abuse this woman in the name of love, And I'm sure, you know, whether it was at the mere level of, you know, sexual gratification or some other emotional need that he was fulfilling, he conned her and dragged her along. So I guess I'll sort of see Ray as the engine that drove this, but certainly Martha was throwing a lot of fuel on the fire.
It's interesting. Did you see that the historical Ray, it's believed that this happened because he apparently was on a ship or something. He's in an accident and he had a frontal lobe injury.
Yeah, yeah. And they play up that scar kind of prominently in the film.
Yeah, but they never talk about it.
Right. They never use it as sort of a rationale or an excuse as to why he behaved this way. But, you know, I'm very much into trauma-focused treatment, and I do believe that, you know, traumatic brain injuries do have a very concrete effect on behaviors. Mm. I mean, I work with that population as children and teens, and I know that, you know, fetal alcohol syndrome and, you know, and severe concussions and things like that really can change a personality in some very fundamental ways. I won't armchair analyze this, but it wouldn't surprise me if both of them had some kind of structural brain or other kind of physical psychological trauma that just warped them in almost a permanent manner. So yeah, I mean, that's just a reality of the world we live in and the way our minds and bodies work.
Mm. Yeah, so I agree, I guess, that they were both kind of pushing each other, and his ambition and her, in the film, his ambition and her jealousy were kind of fueling each other towards this sort of situation. But there were definitely times when she seemed to be more like just being very matter-of-fact about what they needed to do, and then, of course, he telling her, you need to hit this woman. And eventually, you know, she sort of makes the decision in the film to, like, be like, no, we're done here, you know. And he doesn't seem upset about it.
Well, it's because he assured her that he had never laid a hand on Delphine.
On Delphine, which she knew to be not true.
What she knew was not true. And so his most earnest statement of commitment turns out to be a hollow lie.
Yeah.
And she realizes that this just cannot go on. And I think in the sort of poetic narrative arc of this film, it's very powerful. I mean, it says we've reached our limit. Now the real life, as is often the case, is much more complicated than the art.
Yeah.
But the art is making a statement here, is that, you know, you go out on a limb, you give it all up for love, you pledge your undying devotion, and on that kind of raw emotional level, you found your soulmate, and yet this world just wasn't made for people like us, you know.
Yeah.
And so whether that's the tragedy of Romeo and Juliet or the Honeymoon Killers, there's this kind of poignancy, which I think, you know, without going to all of the lurid, bloody extremes that we see these characters go through, I'm sure a lot of audience members can identify with the fact that this couple is kind of fundamentally misfit to be accepted, and yet the attraction is real. That is probably a tangible connection point where maybe this film won its audience in its era, and continues to draw a certain population of viewers in. But there are those other voices who say, "What is this garbage?"
Well, you saw the quote from the director right on the sleeve of the DVD, where it's like, or the Blu-ray, where it's like, "One thing I can say that not many other directors can say: I never made a bad movie after the Honeymoon Killers." <That's right. laughs>
Yeah. Though he was willing to get back in the game. I mean, there was an interview with Leonard Castle. I think it was from the original DVD release. I think he was deceased by the time the Blu-ray came out. But, you know, he had other options, or he was trying to pursue other movie-making opportunities, but they just never quite came together. So, yeah, he's one of these great one-and-dones, him and Charles Lott, right?
And also the guy from Carnival of Souls, right? That guy only made one movie, too. Or no, he made others.
Well,
he made one feature.
He made a lot of production and industrial training videos. But yeah, Carnival of Souls, that's a great connection point. This film really reminded me quite a bit of that. Mm. You want to pick up on that, Josh?
Yeah, no, it definitely has that same kind of that low-budget aesthetic. You know, something that struck me as I was watching it this time is just how flat the lighting is through so much of the film, and there's this part of me that wants to make that mean something more, but it's them really, really shooting with just the available light that they had, and And sometimes, like you were saying earlier, Ark, you get some really beautiful shots in that. Yeah. But then a lot of times you get some really ugly, just very, very uninteresting, brightly lit, flat set pieces. Mm. But I will say that one thing that really struck me is that final scene when Martha goes to take the child down to murder her. There's just this really long take. I rewatched it a couple of times last night because I wasn't sure if I was actually seeing one long take or whether there were some cuts that I just wasn't paying attention to or if I looked down on my notes. But it starts with a shot of Ray watching them coming down the stairs. She takes them down the stairs, and then it pushes in on Ray as he listens to what's happening. And then it pulls back again as he's kind of horrified at what's happened. And it's just this incredible... I know they were doing it for economical reasons, but a couple of those times you get some end up with some really nice shots that were really surprising for a film that, again, the lighting's pretty terrible through a lot of it. The performances are kind of weak, but you end up with some really beautiful images.
I thought that was an excellently rendered scene because there's Ray's head. He's near the door. He's listening in, but then as he hears the splash and the scream of the child, he just backs away. And it's like even he, with his completely, abject moral vacancy, realizes, wow, we've just crossed another line here. Innocent child who had nothing to do with it, we just got to get rid of her.
Yeah.
And again, the distinction between the character and the real life person is kind of irrelevant at this point, because he's bringing the audience on his journey. Like, whoa. And it's whatever sympathy we might have had for Martha and or Ray, I don't want to see her pushing this child into a tub or into a basin or whatever it is. Yeah. But the sound is horrifying just enough. And I think actually the relative restraint, I mean, I honestly, when I first got into this or started watching, I was expecting it to be a lot more crass and vulgar and garish. The violence, I mean, there, it's there, especially with in the hammer kill scene and the blood and the strangulation. You're right, but I thought we were going to be in for a lot more of that. Again, going back to the era, 1970, you could go places with blood and gore, and certainly other films went far beyond this. I mean, even like Night of the Living Dead, which came out a few years earlier, recently reissued, goes much further down that road. But I'm glad in this case they chose not to do that, whether it was for economical reasons or just a matter of taste and discretion and not wanting to push it too far with the censors, since there was still a likely chance that certain scenes could create legal consequences even back in this day.
Yeah. Listening to Leonard Castle's, I rewatched his interview on the disc again yesterday too, and his discussion of the British film censors, that they cut all of the violence from the film.
Yeah.
He really felt strongly that he had made a moral film, a film that showed the horrors of violence.
Yep.
And that by removing the violence, that you make this movie immoral, that you start to romanticize these characters a little more than you should. And I thought that was a really interesting point that he made, that by he walks right up to a line where it's lurid, but it's not too lurid. And then you get the shock and the horror. And I feel like he really humanizes, especially Delphine at the end of the film. And so it's a gut punch when she's killed. And it's really, I get more and more impressed with the craft as much as none of the people involved in this film really knew what they were doing. there are some things that they hit on really beautifully in it that I think we still see in film today. I think that things like Natural Born Killers is another echo of this film in Badlands and Bonnie and Clyde. I think this entire genre of lovers on the run hits a lot of the same. They hit a lot of the same beats. Abandoning the family to run off with your criminal boyfriend, and
to go on a multi-state murder spree.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there is a go for broke romance to all of that, and there is that kind of wish fantasy fulfillment. It's like, you know what? I'm just going to stop caring about everything else. I'm just going to go with this passionate urge that I feel. There is something kind of freeing and liberating about that. But you know, back to your statement there, Josh, Castle's comments and hearing a little bit more of his intentions and his perspective, even if they're delivered, you know, decades after the fact, actually won me over considerably, because I really did. I think my first quick take on this was this kind of like this kind of snide mockery. And it's like, yeah, I kind of get that, but that's not really where I want to come down. I don't really want to be, you know, so locked in on this perspective, like I'm smarter and better and more with it, yeah, more hip, better informed than those squares out there. And I kind of felt a bit of that. And I can understand playing to that audience, but I kind of wanted to go beyond that and to retain some humanity. And I think I understood Castle's intentions a little bit more after hearing his comments on the film and how it all came together.
Yeah, that makes sense. As I suspected, this call has in fact helped me along. You know, it's in a way, this conversation is why I think that one of the reasons I think this film quote unquote belongs in the collection, because it if it was just a bad movie, we couldn't have had this conversation.
Oh, yeah. Right. And there's plenty of trash exploitation from this same era that
they could have put
would
in,
be
yeah.
truly disappointing if Criterion had chosen to release it. Let's talk about Spine number 200.
Yeah.
So okay, number 100 is kind of infamously the Beastie Boys music anthology, which I will make the case.
I will defend that.
It's an incredible DVD collection. To demonstrate the art of the DVD as an object and this really amazing compilation of music videos and all the things that a viewer can do with it. Yeah, completely deserving of that honorary number 100 release, because it was a unique thing and really would not even work on Blu-ray, because you can't do the same kind of multi-view things that a Blu-ray deck offers these days. Number 200 was The Honeymoon Killers. Maybe they meant it to be something special, or maybe it was just luck of the draw. What do you guys think about that?
Well, let's maybe pepper this conversation with a little bit of other surrounding facts. So 300 is The Life Aquatic with Steve Zissou.
Sure.
400, I believe, is is Stranger Than Paradise, the Jim Jarmusch film.
Right, a double feature with Permanent Vacation.
Right. 500 is the War Trilogy, a pretty massive.
That's a massive one.
And they especially renumbered the conventions of that box to make the box number 500, even though the films were 497, 98, 99. So that was kind of a weird little twist on it, right?
600 is Anatomy of a Murder, which I love that film, but, you know, that's what it is. It's the Jimmy Stewart film.
That's pretty major. I think that's pretty significant, right?
700, Fantastic Mr. Fox.
Another tip of the hat.
Wes Anderson.
The Graduate.
The Graduate, sure.
And 900... 100 Years of Olympic Films, which, you know, both David and I are massive, massive proponents of.
Yes.
So not all of those are necessarily huge, but you have to say, I think, pretty clearly that number 200 is by far the one that stands out.
Yeah. As far as not really seeming to live up to it. And
Stranger Than Paradise is probably the closest. I mean, I know it's a doubleheader, but, like, you know, I mean, I like Jim Jarmusch. I don't know if that film is at the same level of some of these others. And The Life Aquatic, I love that film, but a lot of people feel like it's one of Wes Anderson's weaker films. But yeah, 200, yeah. So the question then is what is around it? Because, I mean, 201 is Umberto D. 203 is the BRD trilogy. There were definitely... 208 is the Ingmar Bergman Absence of Faith trilogy.
Right.
I think 199 is Schizopolis.
Yeah, 199, I think they made the right choice.
You know, I wonder sometimes whether we retroactively assign importance to those...
we do.
100 intervals. obviously, the Olympics box set is... Having that at 900 is a pretty huge thing. But
there were films that came out before that one. The Philadelphia Story was 901, but it came out physically before 900. So they staged that one for sure.
Yeah, and the War Trilogy definitely at 500 has a place of centrality in the collection. But yeah, I wonder sometimes whether we think of, you know, Anatomy of a Murder at an even spine number, whether they are thinking that intentionally about some of those choices. I think we can overthink and overanalyze things.
Right. And so much of it just comes down to what's available at the time. And,
yeah.
I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, arcane trivia behind the scenes that we'll never know that kind of govern some of those decisions. So, it probably is best not to read too much into, especially into spine number 200. But, you know, it is also just interesting is that of all the films that Criterion would go on to release, this one here, which is just such a kind of a low budget, indie, off the wall type of thing, maybe in some ways it was easy for them to pick up, but, you know, there are so many other major titles, so many other great masterworks of cinema yet to come, and yet this one here,
especially at that point,
exactly, it registered somehow. What do you think of this? And then of course, I remember a few years ago when they reissued this on Blu-ray, and I by that point had already done like, I don't know, 5 or 6 different Blu-ray wish list episodes. Nobody had ever mentioned Honeymoon Killers.
No.
Yeah, it was a shock.
And I'm like, what in the world is this all about? You know, I will say this 4K restoration is gorgeous. I mean,
look great.
It really, like, you know, we've already said there are some really, you know, very special cinematic moments. And even those kind of, you know, low budget one and done takes are, you know, they are what they are, but it all looks really good. So it gives this indie, low budget, you know, seemingly destined for obscurity film a cachet, kind of a showcase that maybe its directors never even imagined. I wonder if it ever looked this good in the theater after opening night, you know? And same with, again, Night of the Living Dead, another film that is just revelatory in kind of its, you know, eye-popping detail now that all the layers of grime and wear and tear have been stripped away and restored. So, yeah, it's just an interesting phenomena. This film seemed to have a bit of an afterlife. One of you mentioned François Truffaut said it was his favorite American film. I don't know what the context of that quote was. I mean, he might have been trolling for a little bit of a reaction. Maybe that was his favorite American film of early 1970, who knows what, you know. But boy, you know, of all the American films, this is what Truffaut chose to elevate to the top spot. That seems a bit of a stretch to me, but hey.
I did want to mention also, by the way, that the cover for this one is great.
I love it, yes. It's that old cheap comic book, back pages, ads, right.
Yeah, with the heart around the honeymoon, the ad. It's, I mean, really, really, really great. So clearly, I mean, from what I understand of how things happen at Criterion, somebody there must just be a, I mean, there are definitely, if you look at the Criterion Forum, for example, there are definitely staunch defenders of this film who will sing its praises from here till forever. And I think someone at Criterion must be in that club, because this has gotten, first of all, like, you know, the packaging's great. It was great on the DVD, too. They actually, it's one of those situations where they just reused the cover, which in the 200s was a lot less common than it is now. But the cover was great. And so that was great. And then there are actually, for a film of this schlockiness, there are a surprisingly significant number of special features, including a phenomenal video essay we have not touched on, I thought, called Dear Martha, which is about the story of the actual two people. And everything that was different and everything that happened with them. And then it got a Blu-ray upgrade, which I think you and I, David, were on the Blu-ray upgrade episode that month for, I think this was doing when we were doing that show. And I think I said, like, what the heck? And it was just like, no idea. Like, this kind of came out of completely out of nowhere. But yeah, so someone at Criterion must just really love this movie. And I would imagine it's not a particularly expensive or hard to get one.
Right.
This is a definitive cult cinema. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. Josh.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it fits in with, you know, the John Waters stuff we have, and some of the other examples of that low budget exploitation filmmaking. And I really appreciate the fact that they took the time with the supplements, because I think it's one of those ones that's easy to just write off. And when you get Leonard Castle talking about what he's trying to do, when you get this great video essay, it helps you contextualize it so well. And it really makes the film mean more, I think, at that point.
Definitely. This is one worth taking the closer look at. Maybe a few listeners have maybe underestimated or kind of brushed this one off. I will put myself in that camp, at least until now. I've been compelled to watch it, compelled to think about it, live with it for a little bit, and then have a really good conversation with you guys. So, Arik and Josh, thank you very much for joining me and for helping me sort out some of the loose ends here.
Happy to do it.
Let's kind of give each a little bit of a chance to promote things you're up to. Arik, are you back to the history of jazz? Is that happening again?
Yeah. So I had a new episode somewhat recently. You know, that show is on a unpredictable schedule because it turns out it's just a ton of work. But yeah, so I finished my first decade. You'll relate to this, David.
Yes. I was pumping my fist with you. 1919 is done.
So 1919 done, and I'm very excited to start with 1920. We are still going to be in the days of a lot of obscurity. We don't really start to see the big popular names of jazz start to appear on record for another couple of years, but we're getting there. And so I'm starting to get very, very excited. I love telling these obscure stories anyway, but we're going to start to see some of the, you know, the Jelly Roll Mortons and Louis Armstrongs are coming soon. Sure. So that's exciting. It also means that this project is going to explode in a million potential different directions. So I'm a little terrified of what I've, as I'm sure you are sometimes when you look at the spreadsheet of what's ahead
absolutely.
Of you.
Absolutely.
A history of jazz.
Just study progress, that's all.
Exactly. A history of jazz, you can find it at ahistoryofjazz.com or on iTunes or wherever podcasts are. So that's mainly what I'm doing. I still write on my Cinema Gadfly blog. I've been kind of, as my mother pointed out, obsessed with the Olympics. Still kind of watching my way through those and writing about those. And I do have two episodes of Cinema Gadfly, the podcast, that were never released that I just need to sit down and edit and put out. There are two more episodes coming. So just
fantastic.
So that'll be fun as well. And yeah, that's pretty much, you know, and I'm balancing all that with starting a new job. So we'll see how that all goes.
Yeah, that's some pretty exciting ventures ahead for you as well. Yeah. Josh, I think you just did a little bit of filmmaking or produced kind of a trailer. Yeah, tell us about that.
Yeah, so I work for the Episcopal Church in Western Washington, and last April we did interviews with survivors of the Japanese internment camps that are part of our denomination, and so we've been collecting their interviews, and over the last year have been trying to shape them into some short documentaries, and we just released the first one yesterday, actually, and I'm really proud of it. I feel like this is a really exciting opportunity to get to help share these stories, especially in a time when anti-immigration sentiment is up and on the rise, and to be able to show the similarities and the parallels between what happened during World War II and what's happening now. So I feel really fortunate to be able to be a part of it, and we're working hard and going to be releasing about another four short pieces over the next year, and it's been really exciting.
Hello, this is David here. Pretty much just doing a little mop-up operation. Just as Josh started delivering his comment and updating us on the recent project that he's been a part of, his Skype crashed, so at the end of his statement he realized he was basically talking to himself. So, Arik and I, of course, once we heard his sound drop out, did our own little wrap-up and adios, and then a couple minutes later, Josh's Skype did kick back in, and he and I were able to, you know, catch up a little bit, have a good conversation, and part on amicable terms. But anyways, so we were pretty much at the end of the episode, and that was that, so that's the end of our discussion. Links are posted in the show notes on projects that both Arik and Josh have been involved with, as well as other background resources on the Honeymoon Killers and just how to get in touch with us. So I hope you do. And for now, I'll give the last word to Martha and Ray and another guy who knows a little bit something about obsessive love that sometimes goes a little bit over the edge.
Are you nervous? Yeah. Oh. First day's the worst. It's going to be a long trial. You'll get used to it. At least I'll see Ray again. In 4 months now. They tell me he still loves me, but I've been telling him so many lies, I don't know who to believe anymore.
Well, then, I have something nice for you. It's a letter from him. They're allowing me to give it to you.
Can I be alone with it, please?
I'll wait for you over there by the window.
Dear Martha, I would like to shout my love for you to the world. Perhaps someday when we are old and gray, we shall have a little time to spend together. But no matter what happens to us, I want you to remember one thing. You and you alone are the one and only woman I have ever loved. You are the one and only woman I will ever love. Now and beyond the grave. Ray.
Make me feel up, make me free.